And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. Phil, how you doing?
Good afternoon, Phil.
I have been away.
Yes, you have.
And looked at the greatest city that the United States has, San Francisco, in my opinion. They're under a little bit of a threat here.
Well, yeah, forest fires and
out of town. Yeah, the forest fire is near Yosemite Park, but I guess most of us, I didn't realize that the reservoir that provides the water to the city, San Francisco, much of it, is under some threat by this forest fire. So that was a bit of a shock. So there was some power outage and whatnot. Today, by the way, on the Taylor Report, we will be talking with Stephen Gowans. And if you want a preview, just go to, and you're sitting with your computer, of course you are, and your laptop, and your various other things, your iPad. You can check out, it's gowans.wordpress.com. And Stephen is, as we are, very concerned about these headlines having to do with Syria, because we're getting this ominous language about what must be done. Just before leaving for the studio, I read a headline from, and this was from the Christian Science Monitor. I wish there were more Christian scientists as working there as editors. The headline said, "World moves towards action on Syria." You know, the world. Yeah, you know, there is an organization called the UN, and they're not a great, hue and cry in that body, but there is a great deal coming from London, Washington, and Paris, where these are the centers of the Western Western empires, the British, the French, and the Americans. They're the ones who are leading the charge. I didn't realize Chomsky used this language. Chomsky speaks of a phenomenon called the Anglosphere. That's rather helpful. I like that, describing the power centers, particularly London and Washington. And he said they have crimes, endless crimes on their hands, from, you know, genocide to Native Americans, etc., slavery, invading countries, wiping people out, etc., and, of course, uses nuclear weapons, the developments of weapons of mass destruction, which is what they do for, you know, fun and profit. So it's rather important to throw up a roadblock, as Stephen Gowans and others are doing, and saying, I don't know, why aren't we challenging the claims coming from Mr. Cameron and Obama, where they're already drawing conclusions. And these are the states who lied about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And despite that, we have people who, you know, on some days of the week they're sane, like Mr. Siddiqui at the Toronto Star. He has a few moments, but today he went right off the rails. Or, pardon me, Sunday went right totally bonkers. He said that Washington has to, should have acted long ago to bomb. He repeated the same line that I found appalling when I first read it a year ago. Bomb the palaces, Assad's palaces in Damascus. He said, then the problem would be solved. Well, you have to be mad to write something like that. Are you kidding? You're going to bomb, NATO would bomb the palaces of Assad, and then everything would be nice, right? Was he here for Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya? It's unbelievable. That's a Toronto Star. A man gets paid for a living to write such crazy stuff, quite mad. He's an admirer, of course, of the royal family of Kuwait. It's Qatar that he's very fond of. Anyhow, it's a very dangerous situation. We will talk to Stephen Gowans. And talking about the lessons of empire, I want to equate people with a historical reference here that I think helps us understand things. How empires operate and how they don't need to think. Today is the anniversary, August 26, 1807, when a British court, it's actually a court-martial, convicted a British sailor. His name was Jenkins Ratford. And Jenkins Ratford had deserted the British Navy what is now the state of Maryland. He had rowed ashore with some companions that didn't go back. He decided that he liked the diet better, he liked the pay better, and he wasn't too happy at having been forced to be in the British Navy in the first place. So anyhow, he said goodbye to the British Navy, but they weren't too happy about that. And he had three companions with him. So they had a meeting in Halifax, and the commander of the British fleet, the North Atlantic, called it the North Atlantic Fleet, said, I want those men returned. So they spied on the Americans to determine where he was and all that. He signed on to the American Navy. I think he thought, well, if I'm in the Navy, I mean, what could happen? So he gets aboard a ship called the Chesapeake, and they sail out to sea, and they are in international waters off the Virginia coast. And alongside their ship comes a ship called the Leopard, a British ship. And the British ship calls out and says, you have four British sailors aboard. We want them. And you'll turn them over to us now. And the American captain said, no, I don't have any British sailors aboard my ship. I have American sailors. And I'm an American warship. I'm not going to cooperate with you. He said, well, yes, you are. And if you don't, you will receive a broadside. So the American captain said, I'm not prepared to fight anybody. They hadn't sailed out with their guns in place. Everything was laying on the deck to be assembled. So the British captain ordered a broadside, and they killed three American sailors and wounded 30. Then they said, now you're going to surrender. And he did. He said, well, you know, okay. So then they came aboard. They took the four sailors who were, they said, British, because the British did not recognize the right of anybody to give up being British. They said, you're a subject of the crown. And they took them off the American ship, and they allowed the American ship to limp back into port. I guess that was a little lesson for the Americans, because the Americans were a small kind of a Syria-like country, you know, not really a real country. And they took the four to Halifax. And on August 26th, they had a court-martial for Jenkins Ratford, convicted him, and hung him from a yardarm in Halifax Harbor with all the British ships assembled to watch, so that all the sailors would learn, you're not to get off one of our ships, and you cannot retire without the crown saying you can. So that was, he came to a bad end, and that incident, the Chesapeake and the Leopard, was a very interesting moment, because President Jefferson was afraid to fight the British for all his revolutionary talk and all this. And Canadians are all obsessed with Mr. Jefferson, because in a letter once he said going to Montreal would be a matter of mere marching. In the same letter he said, of course, if the war continues, they will sink all of our ships. That's never quoted. He said the British will sink all of our ships. I, by the way, he then advocated terrorism, but I don't want to get completely into that. But you just should know that, you know, this is how great powers operate. So now America today says to Russia, give us Mr. Snowden. They said to Hong Kong, you turn him over. And he had to flee. I mean, he could not have survived, because they have imperial extraterritorial power, and they exercise it in total violation of international law. They don't give a fig for that. The whole thing is how strong they are, and they love to assert it. And of course, I refer to again to Chomsky on this, and I really recommend. Carol Barrett sent us a nice piece, a quote from Chomsky. He says, "You want to fight terrorism? You should first of all stop being a terrorist. That would help." You can find the speech by Chomsky where he just lists all of the illegal behavior of the states, which is, as he points out, the power to do something causes them to ignore international law. Which brings us to Syria today. they're making all this noise about, chemical weapons have been set off in somewhere near Damascus, and we have to act. Well, the Russian ambassador, Mr. Lavrov, and incidentally, you notice how we're not supposed to cite such people, because the only people we can cite are Mr. Cameron, Mr. Baird, Mr. Hollande, or Mr. Obama. But if we cite a Russian, well, then that's outside the pale. Yet, you know, they have a rather long experience. Their state is like other states, and when they have an opinion, probably would pay attention. But Lavrov's position is very clear. He said, you know, there is a UN mission to determine whether chemical weapons were used, and it's only, that's all it's for. There is no mandate to establish blame. The first thing to know is whether an actual, it's like with any criminal law situation, you have to first of all show that a crime has been committed. What, or that the thing happened at all. And we, as I say, we'll be talking to Steve Gowans, who's detailed this. He's written three great articles. That's gowans.wordpress.com. But saying, first of all, you haven't shown that anything happened. Yet the headlines and the editorials are all indicating it's time for NATO to bomb someone we're fed up, blah, blah. And actually, it's become clownish. Mr. Cameron and his assistant's name? Pardon me, Secretary of
Haig?
Yeah, Mr. Haig. So Haig says, oh, well, see, today, 4 days ago, Syria was bad because it wasn't allowing. They said they hadn't made up their mind whether they're going to have these guys go and look at this. Because, you know, they didn't come to Syria to investigate this. Last March, there was a claim of use of chemical weapons. So they're in Damascus to investigate what occurred last March. Because, you know, if you enter the sovereign territory of a state, they want to know why you're there. And they want to be very clear about the parameters of what it is you're going to be doing in their country. That's a big step for any sovereign state. By the way, Canada is never enthusiastic when the UN says it wants to send someone to look at the condition of native Canadians. The Canadian government says no. But there have been instances where they haven't given them visas. Of course, I don't know why Syria didn't recommend bombing when they found that out. But at any rate, so here you have it in the case of Syria. They said, yes, you can come and investigate those things that occurred in March. So when they arrive, this shelling happens, they tell us, and there was, as evidence, someone claims, of chemicals. And America immediately says, you have to now allow this group that came into your country to investigate one thing, to change the modalities to investigate this latest. So Syria took about 2-3 days to make up its mind. So then they said, okay, now you can do it. So all those people said, oh, Syria is obviously hiding a crime, and because they didn't immediately jump through a hoop when we told them to jump through a hoop. Now they've agreed. So now they say, well, no, Mr. Hicks, it's too late. It's too late. I mean, because now you've obviously tampered with the evidence. To which I'd like to say, Mr. Hager, are we all, I mean, try some smelling salts. They're there to investigate something that happened in March. So it's too late now that it's 4 days have gone. March has been by a little while. I noticed that calendars, you know, 30 days, 30 days, 30. So, but they all talk like clowns. It's like John, what's his name? McCain from Arizona. He goes and he says, we have to help the rebels because it's an uneven battlefield. You see, they should have the same kind of weaponry as the government. I'd like to introduce him to the Palestinians and say, I've noticed something, probably draw your attention, Mr. McCain, that the Palestinians seem to be on an unequal playing field. So I would suggest, based on your reasoning, that let's give them some F-16s, some F-17s, maybe some chemical weapons, certainly an atom bomb, you know. Would you be interested in that? You're interested in playing fields and level playing fields. I mean, this level is the top of your head. People with power talking like children in a playground. You know, oh, it's too late. You know, I should have, you know, didn't give us enough opportunity to correct this situation. The Toronto Star today has a funny story. They say that over the weekend, our prime minister was busy. They said pulling levers. You know, a powerful man, he pulling levers. They said he was on the phone to Hollande and to Mr. Cameron, the prime minister. So our prime minister is speaking to President Hollande, and our prime minister is speaking to Cameron. So we're pulling levers. And so in the same article, five paragraphs later, they talk about what Hollande is saying. And Hollande reports that he's been talking to leaders. And the leaders he said he spoke to were Obama and to Cameron and Mr. Rudd of Australia. No Prime Minister Harper. So somebody ought to tell Harper, it might have been a crank call, or somebody might have pranked him. They call that a prank, right? As in the same article, the Prime Minister is right on top of this. He was talking to Hollande. So then, and Hollande says, I've been talking to other leaders, and he lists them, and there's no Harper. And meanwhile, we're supposed to be part of a parade. You know, we're supposed to beat the drum and bang the cymbals to bomb Syria. And we can't even get our story straight of who's been talking to who. And Canadians are asked to be enthusiastic about this. It's really quite a nasty situation. Which is why we will be talking to Stephen Gowans a little later. Some other things, just little details. I have a cultural note here I want to make sure I mention. J.D. Salinger's papers, how about that for a segue, folks? This is Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You're supposed to be able to hit those turns like with the rest of us. J.D. Salinger, the author of Catcher in the Rye, one of the most influential novels and the funniest novels ever written by anybody, his papers are going to be apparently going to be turned into five or six books. Phil, have you read his books?
Well, yeah, when I was 16 years old.
Did you read the Holden Caulfield Catcher?
Right, of
Catcher?
Course. Yeah, I had to sneak it in the house. You know, it was forbidden. Right.
Well, it was forbidden.
Oh, of course. In the school, the church, everybody told you you're not supposed to read it.
See, I never got the message. I went to a guy, a professor I had, handed me the book. He said, Phil, I think you're going to like this. Oddly enough, he used to be an Army intelligence, this guy. And he gave me the book, and I went to the back of the library to sit down and enjoy to have a look at the book. I didn't realize what I had in my hands. I had to stagger out of the place laughing, and everybody in the whole library is looking at me. I didn't know that thing was so explosively funny. And, you know, usually you can control yourself, right? But here I was in a big library. I think it helped that we had a censorious librarian who told me, you know, that if I would ask for the dirty books, he could find them for me, but otherwise I couldn't have them. And I thought, boy, he knows where all the dirty books are. Anyhow, but what interests me about J.D. Salinger, and that I'm looking forward to, is that apparently the book contains his World War II diary. The most important detail, in my opinion, of J.D. Salinger's life, and may have something to do with his reclusiveness, is that he was in the Normandy landing. He was on Utah Beach. And I only know one detail. You know, his daughter broke the family rule and wrote a memoir about her dad. And you don't do that with J.D. Salinger. But what she said was that he often told her that he couldn't get the smell of burning flesh out of his nose. And tells you, I think that Salinger, we should recognize, was probably post-traumatic stress, but we didn't say that. Of course, when the time I heard about these guys, we called it shell shock, but you said that behind the guy's back, but I saw it, several people said, well, you have to look out for Barney, he's shell shock. Anyway, J.D. Salinger landed at Utah Beach. That is going to be, so that's in September. They're going to come out with apparently five or six. There is five or six books to go of Salinger. So we're in for a real treat. But the one you want to, in my opinion, want to look forward to seeing is the his diary of the war. And he wrote it, apparently. He made it available to the guys he served with. And when we say J.D. Salinger was a recluse, he wasn't a play acting, I'm a famous man sitting on a mountain. He was serious recluse. You could not find that guy. He had neighbors who protected him. They said that if you went to the people found the town where he was, you wouldn't find him. Anyway, that's just something I believe should be mentioned. Now, Warston March happened, and Phil Conlon's sitting here, and Phil Conlon attended the march in Washington. And Phil, where were you? When did you arrive? How did you get to Washington?
I was with a group of from a Catholic parish. My aunt was a member of the parish, and she accompanied me, or I accompanied her. And so we had a bus of people from that parish. Left New York City around 6 o'clock in the morning, went down the New
what
Jersey.
What time?
Around 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. Something. It was very, very early. It was about a four-hour drive down the New Jersey Turnpike, whose police force, I have to say, was really out that morning. There were a lot of New Jersey troopers pulling buses over and inspecting them, and
there was a fear that it might become a riot.
Well, that
you notice that?
I know that that's what the papers were saying. I never saw any reason to believe it, and I never saw anything there that day which could be remotely. Could cause a reasonable person to anyway fear anything. It was the most good-natured crowd of people I've ever been in.
I'm really personally tired of the romance of Jack and Bob because they didn't want that demonstration. They tried to stop it. When they realized that it was going to become embarrassing to them, they then let it go ahead. But they had control over the mic. They had to kill basically they could kill the sound system.
Right.
They had it attached. And they also told to use it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons King's speech was nice and tight and short was that they told him he had 12 minutes. And if he tried to go more, bang. Same with John Lewis. The guy they were really looking out for was young John Lewis.
That's right.
From this student nonviolent coordinate. Who could be more dangerous than the guy from the student nonviolent coordinating committee, who'd been, by the way, doing the most evil kind of work, registering black Americans to vote at the risk of his life. I mean, you don't want that guy to give a speech. You definitely want to be, if you're one of the Bobby or Jack, you want to make sure you control that microphone.
I'm trying to remember,
did Lewis
get to give a speech? I'm not even sure on that point, or did they prevent him? I mean, I know there was...
They warned him.
They warned him about what he could say.
By the way, all speeches were vetted.
Right.
And they said, don't deviate. Don't play any games. Tell me again, you're the freest damn country. I mean, you're scared to death.
You know, one of the things I remember a lot of negative press, but the one that I remember most was a right wing columnist, the New York Herald Tribune, whose name was David Lawrence, and his biggest gripe was, he says, you know, all of the shopkeepers in Washington D.C. had to shutter their stores. Shutter. He used the verb shutter, right? He says, who is going to compensate them for the one day of commerce that they lost? And I thought, here you have, one of the greatest expressions of the democratic will of the people, right? And all that this newspaper could think about was, oh, my God, some businessman didn't get to make his sales that day. What an American tragedy that was.
By the way, we've all been, you certainly participated in a demonstration where that's the first thing people raise.
Absolutely.
Oh, you're harming this guy's business. We're going to have to beat all 40 of you up and put you in jail for 5 days. Yeah. What? Because he can't sell a newspaper? One of the things I want to raise here with this is a good friend of John Lewis has written a book called Challenging the Mississippi Firebombers. It's published by Baraka Books. It's Jim Dan. And Jim Dan is, I'm going to full disclosure, is an old friend. He was on our show. Tragically, we did not know that Jim wasn't well. Jim was put up, he was a fighter, so he put up a front that he was all right, and he finished this book that is just now out, Challenging the Mississippi Firebombers. He was there with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, together with John Harris, who we also had as a guest on this program. And in my opinion, you have to read, you have to know what it was like. It's like you sitting, getting up at 6 in the morning and you make the trip and the buses get stopped and that kind of thing. People need to know the details, not that, an iconic speech was given, but how did all this happen? And here we are. Is it 50 years?
It's 50 years.
All right. So 50 years for various little details to come out. The main organizer of the march was Bayard Rustin. Now, Bayard Rustin was gay, so there was an issue about him. They had to make sure he wasn't too prominent. Now it's being talked about, the issues, the problems he went through. But he was the principal individual. And I saw on Democracy Now!, which you get on the CIUT site, and they reviewed all this. And my goodness, Julian Bond, who was also a student nonviolent coordinating committee, one of the smoothest politicians I ever saw in my life, and I mean that as a compliment, he said, suddenly told a story I'd never heard before. He said, people have to understand, Martin Luther King was a great figure and a great orator, but he was not a great organizer. He said, Bayard Rustin said of Martin Luther King that he couldn't bring vampires to a bloodbath. I thought, well, that's important detail.
Yeah, but Bayard Rustin could. That was,
we're talking about an organizer.
There was an organizer.
Yeah, now, but let's give Bayard and some people some credit. Yeah. If you listen to Taylor Report, and this is what you're listening to, 89.5 FM, CIUT, you'll know that we've discovered a thread in American, Canadian history, British history. It's called the Quakers. And their contribution from their small numbers has been immense, huge. I go out of my way now to make sure I know where the Quakers are before I visit any place because of all the great work. Bayard Rustin was a Quaker. He later became a communist. And by the way, I'm a full stop. You got to give credit to people who organized the fight against racism. The Communist Party of the United States has to be there. They ran black members of the party for city council positions, got elected in New York City. You have to understand that. But Bayard Rustin learned a great deal about organizing from both the Quakers and his years in the Communist Party. I don't know the history of his various, but I'll remind you too that Tom Paine, of course, was a Quaker, and Tom Paine, now that I've understood his origins, I notice when I read his books, which are very healthy books, because he loves all humanity. He says it should be a crime for anyone to claim to be royal and to have, because of their bloodline, the right to be called monarch. He said that should be a crime. But when you read that and you think about it, of course, all he's doing in saying that is just being a good Quaker. He sounds amazing and militant and all that, but that's what he is. He's just a consistent Quaker. But
you know, can I say one thing about Rustin? The FBI at that time went out of its way to gather all of the details of people's private lives and their personal lives and who they were intimate with. So Rustin was always having to deal with the fact that the FBI was phoning people and saying, oh, you know, this guy is this and this guy is that, and, you know,
yes.
And you don't want to be associated with a person like that. So and Kennedy actually said, I don't want to meet Rustin. I don't want this guy coming to the White House or anything like
right.
that.
So. Actually, at the White House meeting, you can check the biographies of Martin Luther King. They took King aside personally and said, we can give you the names of Communist Party members who are in your organization, and you have to get rid of them. That was the Kennedy brothers' contribution. They weren't out in the crowd with the others, but at the White House, they told him, you know, how to correct things. I'm going to say one last time, challenging the Mississippi firebombers. Jim Dan, Baraka Books, and I'm hoping we're going to speak to a member of the Dan family here sometime soon about all this. But now we have on the line, I think, pardon me?
Station break.
I'm going to take a break. I'm going to have to teach our friend the break signal. Anyway, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back, and we're going to talk with Steve Gowans.